You're very courageous. You're back for more unpleasantness. The words of encouragement I can give you, it's a long day and I will be talking endlessly, but as the day goes on, things become much more pleasant. So you're going to take your harsh medicine in the morning and then later in the day, a little pleasant sweetener to go with it. As I said, I don't want to do a lot of biographical information, but what I need to introduce you to a few people who are extremely important in the story, in Eliot's life, so you'll know who they are when I make references to them, and there'll be some talked about more than others today. Two names that I didn't mention from his years in France, about 1910, 1911, when he was in France. He shared lodgings with a young Frenchman who was a physician, name of Jean Verdenal, and it was probably the closest friend that Eliot ever had. The two young men were simpatico, got along. Verdenal had a great interest in poetry, in all of the arts. Eliot learned much from him about the worlds of medicine and science, in which medicine, of course, he was interested because he was so ill for so much of his life. But it was simply a matter, the beauty of finding a friend that you can spend time with and trust. Well, among the endless horrors of World War I, which I will speak about in just a moment as we head into the wasteland, was that Jean Verdenal went into the French Medical Corps, was on a ship, and the ship was sunk, and Verdenal died by drowning. And you will see in the wasteland, the briefest section, section 4, which is simply properly called Death by Water, is the first place in the poem where there is some beginning of cleansing or even a hope of restoration. And it has somehow to do with the loss of Phlebas the Phoenician, as he's called in that poem, but also the sense that even though this friend was lost, there was something in the friendship that remains. And as a result, it becomes, I think, a key to the movement beyond the poem. So, Jean Verdenal, when you hear me refer to him, that's who it is. Then, a young Frenchman who was very controversial, very well known by the name of Charles Maurras. You've probably heard of him. He was the founder, leader of Action Française. And the notion was, and it was very important to Eliot, and Eliot picked up on it at once, that there really can be no culture, there can be no civilization without the church. The church is the rock on which everything else is built. Now, Eliot, at this point, was not yet a believer. But what is happening again is certain ideas are beginning to enter his mind that will percolate there for a while before they finally flow out in a very specific direction. So he was fascinated by Maurras, fascinated by Action Française, and the notion that it was extreme. In fact, he refers to him often in letters as cher maître. Later, he corresponded with Maurras. When Eliot went on to edit a little magazine called The Dial, was trying to get Maurras to do some writing for them and referred to him as cher maître, my dear master. Looked up to him that much. But the notion that in literature, classicism was essential, that in religion, the catholique was essential, and indeed, in terms of the construction of society, the monarchique, there had to be the hierarchy. There was a need for that old regime, the old vision of the monarchy, which was hierarchical. These ideas had a great, great impact on Eliot. To prove that point a little bit, I'm jumping ahead now, so I have to find this particular quotation. This is what happens when I improvise, so please put up with me. He speaks at one point of Catholicism as being, here it is. This was written in 1917. It's the year Prufrock comes out. In terms of his expression and what he's putting in his poetry, it's what we talked about last night. It's desolate. It's frightening. It's dark. It's a vision of the emptiness. It's a hint of the abyss that is underlying a world that will not recognize the terrors it is facing. But he's writing about the notion of philosophy, which interested him to a degree. He never officially became a philosopher, but when he went back to Harvard, he studied philosophy, took a PhD in philosophy, wrote his doctoral dissertation on philosophy, but never bothered to defend it, so he never got his degree. Showing he didn't have a lot of interest in academia. He did the work, wrote the dissertation. All he had to do was defend it. Never bothered. Never bothered. Now, of course, many honorary doctorates came later in his life, along with many other honors. But his ideas had moved, and the kind of philosophy he had been studying no longer really interested him, especially the subject of his dissertation, F.H. Bradley. I won't go into it right now. Let's just say he left it behind. But in 1917, he makes the following statement. This is clearly from Morat. I think very clearly in his time talking, getting to know, reading Charles Morat. Catholicism is the only church which can even pretend to maintain a philosophy of its own. A philosophy, as we are increasingly aware, which is succeeding in establishing a claim to be taken quite seriously. Now, at that point, and you'll see it in The Wasteland, Eliot is still, in terms of his intellect, exploring the various religions to which he's been exposed. Having been raised a Unitarian, as he said, the big issues were not dealt with at all. In order to discover what kind of religion could deal with those big issues, he went searching. He studied Buddhism. He studied Hinduism. He learned Sanskrit. He obviously came to look at the various forms of Christianity. But what he discovered, and indeed, the essay in which this comment appears is called A Contemporary Thomist. He'd been reading St. Thomas. And that began, and it's not just he was reading it. What did he find there in the Catholicism that he didn't find elsewhere? A philosophy of its own, okay? Which is succeeding in establishing a claim to be taken quite seriously. So that the ideas are there, okay? The seeds are there. And they will grow eventually. So Morat was extremely important and will continue to be. The name will come back. When he was back getting his doctorate at Harvard, he met a young woman named Emily Hale. They became quite friendly. They spent time together. And then, unable to stay in New England, we're not exactly sure why. Maybe he needed to get away from Harvard. He needed to get away from the old family memories there. In any case, he felt more at home in Europe, went back to England, and they corresponded. For the rest of his days, they corresponded. Those are the letters that are sealed. She saved them. Many of those that came from her to him were saved, but he did not want them to be read by the public. They are very personal. We don't know what's in them. What we do know is she was a remarkably fine young woman. There, again, he met a woman with whom he was simpatico, and she remained a dear friend for all the rest of his days. We don't know what's in the letters, but it's very clear this is the woman he should have married, and he didn't. He went back to England and met Vivian Haywood. Came from a good family, was very vibrant, full of life, into a prominent social scene. But I think he married her fairly quickly for two reasons, both of which inappropriate in a way, although He was still a young man. The first, I would quote from St. Paul, "It is better to marry than to burn." He was now in his late 20s. It's very obvious he had maintained his purity. But in a world saturated with sensualism, it was something that began to trouble him, that he was uneasy with. And he felt an attachment to this woman, and this is the second reason. I think the closest the two ever were when they were dancing. And they both loved dancing, and they were dancing partners. And there was a sense that perhaps this sharing from the dance floor was something that would carry over into marriage. I don't think either of those clearly are the right reason. And it turned into an extremely difficult and very unhappy marriage. We'll get a glimpse of it this morning because he himself said that one of the sources of the wasteland was the pain of the unhappy marriage. And it was clear fairly early on that this had been a bad choice. She was, to her credit, very supportive of him and loved his work and knew very well that her husband was a major figure in the letters and the arts, and she was also a good reader of poetry. So he would pass poems by her, and she was very helpful. When we go to Margate this afternoon, both Eliots were sick all the time. I've already mentioned his health problems. His wife had endless health problems. How many of them were psychosomatic, we don't know. Many of them were very real. It was a couple that was in constant misery, physically, emotionally, spiritually, constant misery, trying to help each other, trying to support each other, and yet so distant and so separate that there wasn't a great deal of help that could be given. Eliot, on frequent occasions, would simply break down. His energy would be gone. I wouldn't go so far as to call it a complete nervous breakdown, but a kind of emotional collapse. He got a job working in Lloyd's Bank when he came back to London. He liked the regularity, and he was very good at it. But he was maintaining the job. He was editing magazines. He was writing poetry. He was in a social circle of intellectuals in England. His health was bad. He was trying to help his wife, whose health was bad. And at times, he would just collapse. It was a different world. The bank was quite willing to give him time off to recover. Nowadays, no business would bother. You show up at the time and, forget. You've already taken your week's vacation. Too bad. But he went to Margate to recover on one of these occasions and then asked Vivian to join him, to come with him. So she was there with him at Margate. So there was, the notion is, and you'll hear it often, that it was a complete disaster. No, there was sympathy there. There was a bond there. It was of some importance. And finally, just simply, I mentioned him last night, Ezra Pound, who oversaw all of Eliot's work, helped him get it originally published, and then saw to it that even though the first book of poems was not well received, did not sell well, there was the second book in 1920, and then Eliot, having worked on The Wasteland for many years, brought it to Pound, and The Wasteland is dedicated to Pound. And Pound is referred to as Il Miglior Fabbro, the better maker. And what it means is, Eliot brought Pound a poem that was twice as long as the poem we now have. And Pound did not rewrite anything in the poem. He edited it. He slashed out sections that he thought weren't effective, slowed the process of the poem, stalled the emotional development. Now, the full manuscript just became available about 20 years ago. It was assumed to be lost, but it turned up again. And it was published. Those of you who might be interested, it's worth looking at. You see the original poem. You see then the poem that Pound extracted out of this much longer work. And you can see very clearly Pound's good sense in getting rid of things. There is a long section in the original draft of the poem where Eliot is doing a parody of Alexander Pope. It's a brilliant parody, but it slows down the movement of the poem. It's not really appropriate, and Pound just took his red pencil, crossed the whole thing out. None of it's necessary. Get rid of it. And he did this throughout the entire, and turned it into the, it's still a long poem, but the compact, powerful poem that we have today. So it's dedicated to Pound. Now, let me just say a couple other things before we get into the poem, and we will do that soon. His Excellency invited me some years ago to the seminary in Winona to talk about the wasteland. And I'm being very fond of the poem. I was happy to do so. I can't even remember the year it was. Let's just say all of us were younger then. I have not listened to that talk again. I'm rarely pleased with anything I do, but I remember being sort of satisfied with that talk. It's available on His Excellency's website. If you want to do a comparison between then and now, it's that earlier talk is available. But there is something that has happened that is very interesting in that it's no longer the same poem. And I'm going to approach it in a very different way. The poem hasn't changed. The words on the page are exactly the same. The reader of the poem has changed. The time in which I live has changed. And as a result, it's not the same poem for me. So that things that I emphasized when I gave that talk many years ago don't interest me in the same way that other things about the poem interest me now. And in fact, curiously, I could almost say it's contradictory in one sense. Eliot was aware of this. Let me read a little passage again. This is from an essay called The Music of Poetry. A poem may appear to mean very different things to different readers, and all of these meanings may be different from what the author thought he meant. For instance, the author may have been writing some peculiar personal experience which he saw quite unrelated to anything outside, yet for the reader, the poem may become the expression of a general situation as well as of some private experience of his own. The reader's interpretation may differ from the author's and be equally valid. It may even be better. It's an astonishing thing for a poet to say. But the notion is, there is a bond between the work and the reader that may somehow not only be different, but could even, a great reader can extract things from a poem that the poet didn't necessarily know was there. There may be much more in a poem than the author was aware of. The different interpretations may all be partial formulations of one thing. The ambiguities may be due to the fact that the poem means more, not less, than ordinary speech can communicate. Well, of course, then, as the reader changes in time, the reading of the poem changes in time and can be different. So that even the poet who put the words on the page cannot say, this is precisely what I meant and there's no other way of reading the poem. Again, this comes in an essay called The Music of Poetry, in that we respond to music in very different ways. And we can take something from a piece of music that a Schubert or a Mozart did not necessarily intend to be the feeling invoked at that moment. It's part of the mystery of art, and it is a great mystery. It reminds me of the moment, it's in the Apology of Socrates, where Socrates is going around trying to find the wisest man in Athens. And the second group he goes to are the poets. And he says, and I was astonished to learn they didn't know anything about their own poems. Because Socrates, I had assumed, since they wrote them down, they could tell me what their poems meant, and they couldn't do it. So I realized they were the instruments through which something of the divine was working to put something down that then becomes of greater value than the medium through which the poem passed. It's a fascinating idea. But Eliot is quite able to say, there may be much more to my poem than I think is there. And he would be very interested, probably, to find out what others made of it. The reason I bring this up, I base the talk at the seminary on a line that comes very near the end of the poem, called in which the poet says, "These fragments I have shored against my ruins." And my vision was there are bits and pieces, the civilization, Western civilization, coming apart. And aside from the voices that go in and out of the poem, there are endless references to other works of poetry, to works of drama, to Wagnerian operas. It is packed to Greek myths, to figures from Greek mythology. It is packed with all these references. And what struck me back then was the fragmentary nature of the poem. And my vision was the poet trying to hold on to little pieces of that civilization that is flying apart, because it is the only thing he can hold on to shore him up against the ruin that he feels coming. Now what has hit me, coming back, looking at it again some years later to talk about it, is that he takes the pieces, and like putting together a jigsaw puzzle, when you are done, there's a synthesis and a complete picture that makes sense. I am now struck by the uniformity and synthesis of the fragments that create one whole work of art. And Eliot himself also speaks of this. "The poet's mind is in fact a receptacle for seizing and storing up numberless feelings, phrases, images which remain there until all the particles which can unite to form a new compound are present together." Fragments, ideas, feelings that just get stored up, and suddenly they come together and become one thing. He emphasizes it again in a different essay he wrote. He's talking about Dante. By the way, he loved Dante. As he said at one point, Dante and Shakespeare divide the world between them. There is no third. Well, I think if there is a third, it's Mr. Eliot, but he would never say that of himself. But they are the two that in his mind define the modern world, help us understand what's been going on. "When a poet's mind is perfectly equipped for its work, it is constantly amalgamating disparate experience. The ordinary man's experience is chaotic, irregular, fragmentary. The latter falls in love or reads Spinoza, and these two experiences have nothing to do with each other or with the noise of the typewriter or the smell of cooking. In the mind of the poet, these experiences are always forming new wholes so that the pieces come together and create something that is absolutely new." So the fragments are still there. Looking at the poem now, I no longer see them as fragments. I see them as providing a means of putting together a complete picture. Now, I've already said a good bit about what it was that caused him to write the poem, and it certainly makes sense in that it was a terrible time. He had been through World War I. He had a sense of what it meant. Quite literally, the total collapse of Western civilization and what the West thought it possessed. His own problems in his marriage, the tensions and problems in the marriage, revealing to him something about the nature of love that wasn't what he had held to in his own romantic view. Again, it may be one reason for his turning against the romantics. The shallowness, the complete shallowness of the world in which he lived, the emptiness, the overwhelming burden of nothingness in day-to-day life, extremely, extremely painful. All of that is there in the poem. I want to read you one quotation, and this came... I'm not going to say a lot about the war, but I do need to say this. We have, as Shakespeare has Macbeth say near the end of the play, "I have supped full of horrors." The modern world, the world we're living now, has supped full of horrors. We are just imbued in it from an early age. And you have to somehow breathe it in and deal with it to keep going. The shock back then was staggering. This is a commentary written by Eliot's brother-in-law, Vivian's brother, who was on the battlefield in World War I. And Eliot saw to it that this letter got published. He wanted this made public. This is Maurice Heywood's description of being on the battlefield in World War I. A leprous earth, scattered with the swollen and blackening corpses of hundreds of young men. The appalling stench of rotting carrion mingled with the sickening smell of exploded lyddite and ammonal. Mud like porridge, trenches like shallow and sloping cracks in the porridge, porridge that stinks in the sun. Swarms of flies and bluebottles clustering on the pits of offal. Wounded men lying in the shell holes among the decaying corpses, helpless under the scorching sun and bitter nights, under repeated shelling. Men with bowels dropping out, lungs shot away, with blinded, smashed faces, or limbs blown into space. Men screaming and gibbering, wounded men hanging in agony on the barbed wire until a friendly spout of liquid fire shrivels them up like a fly in a candle. It's horrifying. It's horrifying. But it's the beginning of a kind of modern warfare. I have a former student who has become a medical doctor in the Navy who served his internship at Bethesda and described the American soldiers coming back from the Middle East who in normal circumstances would have died, but science has kept them alive, and now they're being brought back to the hospital where they are just fragments of human beings suffering unbelievable torment. He described one in particular who had lost three quarters of his skull and the brain was exposed, who had to have his hands tied to the sides of the bed because all he wanted to do was commit suicide by plunging his hands into his own brain and end life. 100 years later, and we are at the same point, it gets worse and worse and worse. And all I would say, it's something my friend Patrick says all the time, the explanation for the horrors of World War I, the best explanation does not come from the historians, it comes from Our Lady at Fatima. War is a punishment for sin. And she said directly, unless mankind repents, a second and greater war will come. And it came, and it was worse in its way, horrifying. Although mankind was getting used to war. Since then, wars everywhere. Now this endless debacle in the Middle East, just grinding up young men and spitting them out. At the same time that these phony abstract words of freedom and honor and country have emptied of all meaning, mean absolutely nothing. And what do we know? Not only has mankind continued to sin, the sins get worse, the sins become more grave, so that the vision of a next war that will be unimaginably horrific looms over us every day, and any of us with sense know it's probably coming and know why it's coming, and it could have all been prevented if the consecration had been done to Our Lady's Immaculate Heart. Pause for a little reminder. Remember to pray for the repose of the soul of Father Gruner, who did more than almost anyone imaginable to try to get Our Lady's message out and to see that the consecration was done. So, a good priest. God grant him repose. God grant him repose. Here's Eliot between the two wars. Whatever happens will be another step toward the destruction of Europe, in quotation marks. The whole of contemporary politics oppresses me with a continuous physical horror, like the feeling of growing madness in one's own brain. It is rather a horror to be sane in the midst of this. It is too dreadful, too large, for one to have the comforting feeling of superiority. It goes too far for rage. That's between the wars. In any case, the war was a shock. His personal situation was a shock. And he looked again honestly at the world in which he found himself and wrote about it, put it down in poetry. Now, His Excellency did a scheme of the poem for a lecture he gave in Lareja. He's been willing to share this with us, and I'm going to use this to take us through the poem, so you have something to look at that I think will be very useful as we go through it all. He worked on the poem for many years. It was finally published in 1922. It came as a shock. It had a measure of success, but it was unlike anything anyone had seen before. The thing that this scheme does so well is it points out there is an order to the poem. The seeming randomness of the poem is actually part of a plan. That makes perfect sense as we move through it. So what I'm going to do, the poem is written in five parts. We'll go through it part by part. I'm not sure how far we'll get, but we can finish it up this morning at the second lecture. Couple things by way of introduction, and you'll notice at the top, the original title was, as I said last night, He Do the Police in Different Voices. So it's a poem of multiple voices. And then secondly, the dead land, the wasteland of the entire poem, comes from a myth that Eliot first encountered in the Arthurian legends, the myth of the Fisher King. The same year that the wasteland was published, James Joyce published Ulysses. And Eliot had read sections of Ulysses before the full novel was published. And he found it very helpful for this reason. What he took from Joyce was that the old myths could be used to structure a modern work, so that in Joyce's Ulysses, the homecoming of Odysseus is equated to Leopold Bloom strolling around Dublin and at the end coming back to his house. So the glory of the Greek myth is miniaturized, brought down to the mundane. For Joyce, that was a good thing. And Joyce ends up reveling in the sensual, quite content with the world, as long as we live in the world as the Jewish figure Leopold Bloom does, who is an outcast in Catholic Dublin, but indulging himself in all the senses and finding a life of the senses that keeps him going, and not even minding that his wife is having an affair. And it's an ugly picture. And it's combined with the fact that Joyce blasphemes throughout the entire novel. People objected to its obscenity. Had there been a sane, rational culture, they would have objected to its blasphemies. Joyce not only rejects the Catholic faith he was brought up in, he mocks it in ways that are appalling, absolutely appalling. Now, so Eliot said he thanked Joyce for giving him the notion of the myth that can structure a work, but then he said, I wish I had not read the book. Tell me which one is the healthier mind. The two works are linked together. The works are very different. For one thing, and this will become clear as we go along, for Joyce, he has found comfort in a way to live in the world. For Eliot, in the wasteland, the world is a horror, and he is seeking to understand it because he knows there must be something higher, better, nobler. But in the poem, he's looking, he hasn't found it yet, and the world he's living in is desolate, ruined. The Fisher King myth, it appears in various versions, so the basics are just this. The king of the land has been crippled, ruined, struck. In some it's a curse, in some it's a physical affliction. But as he has become crippled as king and useless, his land has gone dead. There's no fertility. There's no life. There is nothing but dust and death. And it cannot change until a worthy knight dares to go to the perilous chapel, a place that's been taken over by evil spirits. And when he gets there, answering certain questions correctly, and when he answers the questions correctly, the land will be freed, the king will be healed. So in a way, the structure of the whole poem is seeking for the healing. But in the poem, and you'll find references throughout the poem to fishing, sitting fishing, and the fisher king is just biding time, waiting for the knight to come to heal the kingdom. In many of the myths, it turns into a search for the Holy Grail. The Grail has been lost. And until one of Arthur's knights can recover the Grail, the land is stricken and nothing can grow, nothing can happen. As I say, it comes in various forms. But that is the myth behind the poem. So where do we begin part one? As His Excellency says, in the first part, the problem is undefined in a sense, but we get the feeling something is very wrong. Something has gone extremely wrong. And in order to do it, what Eliot does quite brilliantly. Part one is called The Burial of the Dead. And what the first part of the poem attempts to do is keep the dead dead. We prefer winter because winter doesn't make us face the prospect of life. And if life comes, we know it will just lead to more death. In order to make the point, he begins the poem with an echo of one of the most famous openings of a poem in all of English literature. Everyone used to know it. It's not well known now. I remember when I was in high school, I was a sophomore in high school, and everyone was in terror of senior English because Miss Pearl Lamphere taught senior English, and she was a bear. She was one of those lady teachers, God bless her, who devoted her life to teaching, and not sentimentally. She beat grammar into the students. She beat literature into the students. She made them work. She taught them to write. I had a woman like that in 8th and 9th grades who gave me my profession, Marie Cal. God bless her memory. These ladies were everywhere. They were tough. But they loved poetry. Why? Because, as I said last night, poetry is of the heart. It starts here first. And gentlemen, the women have it all over us when it comes to the heart. So they can respond first and foremost to poetry in a certain way. And then we men can explain bits and pieces of it later. But the ladies get it first, where it matters foremost, okay? But then if they went on to become teachers, by gum, they were going to be, most of them unmarried ladies, so their students became their children and they beat it. they were disciplinarians and sought to. Anyway, one of the things that terrified people about Pearl Lanfear is she made everybody learn the opening of this poem, which is the beginning of the prologue to Chaucer's Canterbury Tales in Middle English. And she made them learn it in Middle English. So not only did she make them learn poetry, she made them learn the poetry in Middle English, which to them was a foreign language. And I remember the seniors just in terror. I can't memorize this. I don't know what any of it means. But you know, I have to have it done by next Thursday, or she'll flunk the course. I won't go to college. What do I do? You know? But she would be. And I, of course, was looking forward to it. I thought it'd be. I couldn't wait to get Slatey. I'd already been through Marie Cal. I had no fear of Pearl Lamphere. But what happened, of course, she retired the year before I got there. In the same way that when I headed into high school, they dropped the teaching of Latin. I didn't get Latin. I didn't get Pearl Lamphere. But I learned it on my own, and I will now bore you by reciting it. But what I want you to do, since it is Middle English, is sort of a foreign language. You'll get some of it. Listen to it with the directions I gave last night, which is, there's music in the sound. There's music in the sound. And it's this that Eliot is playing off against in the opening of the Wasteland. The prologue, the original prologue to Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. Wan that April with his shore is sota, the drucht of March hath pierced to the rota, and bathed every vine in switchly cour, of which vertue engendered is the floor. Wan that Zephyrus ache with his sueta breatha, in spirit hath in every holt and hatha the tundra croppes, and the younger sonna hath in the ram his halva course aerona, and smaller fool and mocking melodia that sleepen all the nicht with open ear, so pricketh him natur in her courages, than longen folk to go on pilgrimages, and palmers for to say constrangest rondes, from fairna hallways couth in sundry londes, and specially from every shearer's enda of England to Canterbury they wenda, the holy blissful martyr for to seeka, that them hath holpen when that they were sicka. It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. But the vision is a world bursting back to life. When April with his sweet showers has pierced the drought of March to the root, okay, and bathed every vein in such liquid by which the flower springs forth, when the little birds, okay, sleep all night with open eyes because they're so excited that the spring, so pricketh him natur in her courages. So everything is returning to life. And humankind is returning to life by knowing it needs to make a pilgrimage to the holy place, Canterbury, where they will pay homage to the saint, St. Thomas a Becket, murdered at Canterbury, from whose blood they now, because he is a martyr, have been able to appeal to him in their sickness, and the saint has helped to heal them. It is new life. It is the flowering of spring. It is the chirping of birds. It is the pilgrimage to Canterbury. It is the healing blood. It is the new life. It is sickness being overcome. It's medieval. It's Catholic to its core. That world's dead. And Eliot is playing off that world. By the way, interesting, and we'll get to it later today, Eliot is going to make his own pilgrimage to Canterbury and will encounter St. Thomas a Becket. But he doesn't know it yet as he's writing the parody here. If you will, the other side. Here we go. Let me take it through. We'll go through the schema first. Where do we begin? First part. Down with spring, His Excellency says, okay? Spring returns, only death returns. There's a memory of the past, there's a desire for the future, but there isn't a present. The present doesn't seem to exist, okay? Hence, winter is better. Do not give us spring. We don't want spring. Then the voice changes. We begin with the poet's voice, then the voice changes. A highly civilized pre-World War I scene, but everything is collapsing. We hear the voice of Marie, okay, who was the cousin of the Archduke Ferdinand who was shot. By the way, Eliot takes this from her memoirs. He read her memoirs and incorporates her voice, the young girl's voice, into the poem. Her memories of the good days before the war. So back then, there was something wonderful that seemed civilized. We go back to the poet's voice. Echoes of Ezekiel. We're in the present. There's nothing but shattered images, and then we get the desiccated Wagnerian passion. We get bits of German from Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, the ultimate romantic opera. Then a little hint of genuine romance, okay, but it fails. Desire itself is meaningless. There's no direction, no behind, no before. And then we meet Madame Sosostris, the fortune teller, okay? This is modern spirituality. It's not taking a pilgrimage to Canterbury to pray at the martyr's shrine. It's having the fortune teller come with her tarot cards to tell you what the future is going to be, okay? She's, and it's good, fraud amongst frauds. And that in the tarot cards, we meet certain characters that then will appear throughout the poem. And then the poet, we're back in London, and he sees London as Dante's Inferno, London as hell. And we get the horrible vision of, I did not think that death had undone so many. It's a line from Dante, who sees the damned souls lining up at the river to be carried across by Charon in his boat and finally arrive in hell for all eternity. Here you'll see it's all those poor, empty souls crossing London Bridge to go to their meaningless jobs every morning. It's hell in modern life. We try, and then a voice, one man, we recognize somebody. He fought with the poet in the Peloponnesian Wars. I mean, it's just, you know, as I said, time just whirls around. It gets compacted. And the question is, oh, I know you buried a body last spring. Has it started to sprout yet? Or did the dog come and just bring it up, dig it up before? And a line from John Webster's The White Devil. Oh, keep the dog far hence, or with his claws, he'll dig it up again. Whew. Then he ends with a quote from Baudelaire, where poetry itself is a fraud. The poet's a fraud. The reader of poetry is a fraud. Everything's a fraud. That's the lovely first section of the poem, called The Burial of the Dead. Now, I would say listen rather than look at the schema, because you'll be able to hear these changes going on. April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. Summer surprised us, coming over the Starnberger See. With a shower of rain, we stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked for an hour. Bin gar keine Russen, stamm ich Litauenek Deutsch. And when we were children, staying at the Archduke's, my cousins, he took me out on a sled, and I was frightened. He said, Marie, Marie, hold on tight. And down we went. In the mountains, there you feel free. I read much of the night and go south in the winter. What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Son of man, you cannot say or guess, for you know only a heap of broken images where the sun beats and the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water. Only there is shadow under the red rock. Come in under the shadow of this red rock, and I will show you something different from either your shadow at morning striding behind you, or your shadow at evening rising to meet you. I will show you fear in a handful of dust. Frisch weht der Wind der Heimat zu, mein irisch Kind, wo weilest du? You gave me hyacinths first, a year ago. They called me the hyacinth girl. Yet when we came back late from the hyacinth garden, your arms full and your hair wet, I could not speak, and my eyes failed. I was neither living nor dead, and I knew nothing. Looking into the heart of light, the silence, öd und leer das Meer. Madame Sesostris, famous clairvoyant, had a bad cold, nevertheless is known to be the wisest woman in Europe, with a wicked pack of cards. Here, she said, is your card, the drowned Phoenician sailor. Those are pearls that were his eyes. Look, here is Belladonna, the lady of the rocks, the lady of situations. Here is the man with three staves, and here the wheel, and here is the one-eyed merchant, and this card, which is blank, is something he carries on his back, which I am forbidden to see. I do not find the hanged man. Fear death by water. I see crowds of people walking round in a ring. Thank you. If you see dear Mrs. Equitone, tell her I bring the horoscope myself. One must be so careful these days. Unreal City. Under the brown fog of a winter dawn, a crowd flowed over London Bridge. So many. I had not thought death had undone so many. Sighs short and infrequent were exhaled, and each man fixed his eyes before his feet. Flowed up the hill and down King William Street, to where St. Mary Woolnoth kept the hours, with a dead sound on the final stroke of nine. There I saw one I knew and stopped him, crying, "Stetson, you who were with me in the ships at Miley, that corpse you planted last year in your garden, has it begun to sprout? Will it bloom this year, or has the sudden frost disturbed its bed? Oh, keep the dog far hence that's friend to men, or with his nails he'll dig it up again. You, hypocrite lecteur, mon semblable, mon frère." Well. Oh, I love it. I love it. What can you say? What can you say? Please notice, the sounds themselves will do it. If you do not know the references, there is still this strange sense of mystery, and you're getting the impressions. Death, emptiness, the fraudulent nature of so much that is it's a world of fraud at best. And death is desired. Death is desired. Just a couple of quick comments. I think I can do this. The notion of the terrible Dante, and I mean, the world's become a living hell in Eliot's eyes. It is. It's the inferno, but not in the afterlife. It's here in this world. That vision of them going over the bridge, up and down, where Mary Woolnoth, and he noticed this when the hours were struck at St. Mary Woolnoth, on the final stroke of nine, the sound was dead. It was a dead sound. He incorporates it into the poem. Now, of course, this is the beauty of the poetry. Nine is also when you have to report to work. Eliot had to be at the bank at nine. So it's a dead sound at nine indeed, because at least when you're crossing London Bridge, even if you're shuffling and half dead, it's not as bad as sitting in the office doing figures, okay? And a little reminder, here it is already. Who gave up the ghost at the ninth hour? Who died at the ninth hour? And there is the hint in the background of salvation, but it's just a hint there, because the world knows nothing about it. Just the richness of the associations. Stunning. Now, I want to do one thing here. I'll take a minute and do this. The notion stayed with him. He did not lose this notion, but it would be transformed in later work. The same something similar appears in the first of the four quartets, Burnt Norton. I'll explain all that later. Third part of Burnt Norton. It's the same vision, but now it's the vision coming from the man who has come to understanding. He now believes. He now believes. But he can still present a vision that's horrifying, but it is surrounded by other things at this moment. But he hasn't lost that earlier sense. What's happening here is not them walking over the bridge, but we're in the underground. We're in the London Underground with everybody heading off to work. Here is a place of disaffection, time before and time after, in a dim light, the underground. Neither daylight, investing form with lucid stillness, turning shadow into transient beauty, with slow rotation suggesting permanence, nor darkness to purify the soul, emptying the sensual with deprivation, cleansing affection from the temporal, neither plenitude nor vacancy, only a flicker over the strained, time-ridden faces. The image, when you're riding the subway, and occasionally a light will flash. So he's watching the light occasionally flashing on all these dead souls sitting in the tube. And as he looks them, what does he see? Only a flicker over the strained, time-ridden faces, distracted from distraction by distraction. You could add another one now with the little devices, okay? Filled with fancies and empty of meaning, tumid apathy with no concentration, men and bits of paper whirled by the cold wind that blows before and after time, wind in and out of unwholesome lungs, time before and time after, eructation of unhealthy souls into the faded air, the torpid, driven on the wind that sweeps the gloomy hills of London, Hampstead and Clerkenwell, Campden and Putney, Highgate, Primrose and Ludgate, not here. Not here the darkness in this twittering world. Eructation of unhealthy souls. The subway, the underground, vomits out the unhealthy. Eructation means to belch, to get rid of that inside you which is foul. It's a ghastly vision of these dead souls who have been on the underground going to work are now suddenly belched out up above into the torpid, empty air. Wind in and out of unhealthy lungs as they go off. It's the same vision. It's the same vision. But please notice what we have here is that there are ways to escape it, okay? Emptying the sensual. Darkness purifying the soul. I love this line, but you don't even get that. Not here the darkness in this twittering world. Twittering! They are twittering. They're tweeting. It's prophetic. It's prophetic. Modern man twitters and tweets like the birds do. He's become a bird brain. Twittering and tweeting. It's absolutely extraordinary. Simply extraordinary. So he lost none of it. Now, I'm going to go right into part two. This we'll do fairly quickly, and then we'll read it. Now the problem becomes specific in part two, as His Excellency says. The problem is love has been corrupted. Love has gone bad. Love, which is the only possible healing thing. This has got to come out of the failed marriage, the bad marriage. And indeed, there are aspects of the conversation you'll hear here that have to have come out of Eliot's own marriage. Frightening. What do we get? We get the upper class in the first part, okay? A wealthy apartment of a modern woman. It's described in the line Shakespeare writes when Cleopatra comes down the Nile in her barge to first meet Antony. And as His Excellency says here, every woman is now an empress. Isn't democracy wonderful, okay? Material, sensual, stuff. But at the core of it all is spiritual rape and violation. And we get the story of Philomel, the rape, Tereus and Philomel raped but turned into the nightingale, okay? The dialogue of the poet, husband and the distraught wife, hint of Desdemona, death, Othello killing Desdemona, a line from Othello, right before when Desdemona is getting ready for bed. And here's the wind at the door before Othello comes in and kills her. It's murderous love. It's murderous love. Emptiness. And then we go to a pub. Now we go to the lower class. The women are gossiping in the pub. The pub is closing down. You'll hear the call. And it is all ugliness, fakeness, superficiality, abortion. And we end part two with another quote from Shakespeare, the last lines of Ophelia, before she goes out mad and drowns. Okay? It's, as I said, how unpleasant to meet Mr. Eliot. Part two is called A Game of Chess. Why? It's twosomes. But it's also, there's a play by Thomas Middleton called Women Beware Women. And at the center of it is two women playing chess. And they're playing chess to keep themselves distracted from evil things going on around them, okay? So here the chess game is conversation, back and forth. Part two, a game of chess. The chair she sat in, like a burnished throne, glowed on the marble, where the glass held up by standards wrought with fruited vines, from which a golden cupidon peeped out. Another hid his eyes behind his wing, doubled the flames of seven-branched candelabra, reflecting light upon the table as the glitter of her jewels rose to meet it, from satin cases poured in rich profusion. In vials of ivory and colored glass, unstoppered, lurked her strange synthetic perfumes, unguent, powdered, or liquid, troubled, confused, and drowned the sense in odors. Stirred by the air that freshened from the window, these ascended in fattening the prolonged candle flames, flung their smoke into the lacquer aria, stirring the pattern on the coffered ceiling. Huge seawood fed with copper burned green and orange, framed by the colored stone, in which sad light a carved dolphin swam. Above the antique mantle was displayed, as though a window gave upon the sylvan scene, the change of Philomel, by the barbarous king so rudely forced. Yet there the nightingale filled all the desert with inviolable voice, and still she cried, and still the world pursues, jug, jug, to dirty ears. And other withered stumps of time were told upon the walls. Staring forms leaned out, leaning, hushing the room enclosed. Footsteps shuffled on the stair, under the firelight, under the brush. Her hair spread out in fiery points, glowed into words, then would be savagely still. My nerves are bad tonight. Yes, bad. Stay with me. Speak to me. Why do you never speak? Speak. What are you thinking of? What thinking? What? I never know what you are thinking. Think. I think we are in Rat's Alley, where the dead men lost their bones. What is that noise? The wind under the door. What is that noise now? What is the wind doing? Nothing. Again. Nothing. Do you know nothing? Do you see nothing? Do you remember nothing? I remember those are pearls that were his eyes. Are you alive or not? Is there nothing in your head? But, oh, that Shakespearean rag! It's so elegant, so intelligent! What shall I do now? What shall I do? I shall rush out as I am and walk the street with my hair down. So, what shall we do tomorrow? What shall we ever do? The hot water at 10, and if it rains, a closed car at 4, and we shall play a game of chess, pressing lidless eyes and waiting for a knock upon the door. When Lil's husband got demobbed, I said, I didn't mince my words. I said to her myself, hurry up, please. It's time. Now, Albert's coming back. Make yourself a bit smart. He'll want to know what you've done with that money he gave you to get yourself some teeth. He did. I was there. You have them all out, Lil, and get a nice set, he said. I swear, I can't bear to look at you. And no more can't I said. And think of poor Albert. He's been in the army 4 years. He wants a good time. And if you don't give it to him, there's others will, I said. Oh, is there, she said. Something of that, I said. Then I'll know who to thank, she said, and gave me a straight look. Hurry up, please. It's time. If you don't like it, you can get on with it, I said. Others can pick and choose if you can't. But if Albert makes it off, it won't be for lack of telling. You ought to be ashamed, I said, to look so antique. And her only 31. I can't help it, she said, pulling a long face. It's them pills I took to bring it off, she said. She's had 5 already and nearly died of young George. The chemist said it would be all right, but I've never been the same. You are a proper fool, I said. Well, if Albert won't leave you alone, there it is, I said. What you get married for if you don't want children? Hurry up, please. It's time. Well, that Sunday, Albert was home. They had a hot gammon, and they asked me into dinner to get the beauty of it hot. Hurry up, please. It's time. Hurry up, please. It's time. Good night, Bill. Good night, Lou. Good night, May. Good night. Ta-ta. Good night. Good night. Good night, ladies. Good night, sweet ladies. Good night. Good night. It's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking. Part three is called the Fire Sermon. And the problem gets spread out across a wider panorama. The Fire Sermon comes from Buddhism. It's one of the central texts in the Buddhist religion. Equivalent, not equal, but something like the Sermon on the Mount, where the principles are laid down, where the Buddha gives his principles. And there are just a few quick words from it that occur in the poem. Again, it's the sense of a glory that's been desolated, something that was beautiful in the past, that was worth preserving, that's gone and has been destroyed. We begin with the River Thames. The river has been desolated, okay, by the modern big city. It's stripped of its beauty. And now it's so stripped there isn't even garbage flowing in it. We get a little hint of the Fisher King. Somebody's fishing in the river, so the Fisher King is there. But he's lost his kingdom, his honor, it's corrupt. And everything's mechanized, and the love again is sour, gone. The real love has vanished. We again get the rape myth of Philomel, but it's broken off. And then we get a hideous attempt by a Jewish businessman who's, as we say euphemistically in the States, whose life in his light in his loafers. To seduce the poet himself and carry him off to a weekend of fun and money at one of the swank hotels. Again, it is twisted, ugly love, which of course now is not only promoted in the modern world, but honored. It's madness. Then Tiresias appears, the figure from Greek mythology. Who is cursed. He came upon two snakes copulating and took his stick and whacked them. And Hera, the goddess of the earth, was so angered that he had interrupted their earthly pleasures, she turned him into a woman so that he would find out what it meant to be a woman. So he's been a male. He suddenly becomes a woman. He has male breasts, and it's a hideous curse. Now, of course, it's a great honor if you know Bruce Jenner in America. I pick up the paper, I read that Jenner's developing breasts now, thanks to hormone treatments. And I say, what a great modern world I live in, where a decathlon champion can now fully fulfill himself after three marriages, six children, by growing breasts and becoming a woman. The Greeks knew better. It's a curse. It's a curse, okay? And it's again twisted love. And then we get a very horrible presentation. A typist coming home after meaningless work, and her boyfriend comes, and there's a passionless act. He's a young city man, full of himself and empty. It's all meaningless. Totally line from Oliver Goldsmith, where love was honorable back in an earlier age. At the end of this meaningless act, she looks in the mirror, sees nothing there, and turns on the gramophone. So at least we can have scratchy romantic love from the gramophone, even if no love is possible in real life. And then we get glimpses of some health. There are some workmen in a bar, fishermen. Elliot would hear them. It's the healthy part of fishing. And there was life, some life. These men going out in nature doing actual work. And then the inside of the beautiful church with the marble that was near where the fishermen. So a little glimpse of the glories of the past. Then we get the vision of Elizabeth I and Leicester floating down the River Thames in glory, the queen and her consort and the crowds. And now we just get the three Thames maidens, again taken from Wagner, the Rhine maidens, and thereby this filthy modern river and they're singing of their empty love. All three have been seduced or had some sort of ugly experience. And then a hint of St. Augustine, a quote from the Confessions, and then the quote from the Buddha fire sermon, burning, burning, burning. And the Buddha saying you have to burn up those passions within yourself to get rid of them, to clear them, so they will be gone. And we get the two different traditions. Please notice what Eliot is doing. He's searching. So he was reading St. Augustine and impressed. He had read the Buddha and felt there was something there. But at this point, he doesn't know which, what, where to turn. Is one superior? He's questing. He's looking. The poem is indeed, in many ways, a spiritual quest. Now, what I'm going to do is, when we go to Margate this afternoon, I'll read part three, where it was written. He had written the first two parts and the first part of part three, and then was blocked for a long time, couldn't write. Thought the poem was nothing, was going to abandon it. He came down to Margate for a rest cure. Vivian then came down with him. He's sitting at the little pavilion where we are going, looking at the sea, and suddenly, the last 50 lines of part three, he put down while he was sitting there. And he finished part three, and then the rest of the poem was written shortly thereafter, when he'd gone to Lausanne, Switzerland, and he finished it up there. So you're going to a historic place in world literature, and the pavilion is still there, and the sea is still there. But I suspect the pavilion is somewhat run down from what it was in Eliot's time, proving once again the modern world is all about dissolution and decay. We'll pick it up there at 11, I guess. Yes, 11, I'll continue with some more.